Today's episode of the Children's Literature Podcast is brought to you by Earplugs. Earplugs. Sometimes the only thing to do about a tantrum is wait it out in less discomfort. Welcome to the Children's Literature Podcast. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. This episode is called Code Switching in the Secret Garden. This is the second to last of a series focusing on the three novels that Frances Hodgson Burnett wrote for children. In all of them, Little Lord Fauntleroy, A Little Princess, and The Secret Garden, characters speak in dialects that reflect their personal background and social status. This was meant to be a four-part series, but I found as I was preparing this last installment that there's simply too much to discuss about The Secret Garden's use of the Yorkshire dialect. So this week, I'll cover the concept of code switching and the way speech and social class are tied together. Next week, I'll do a close examination of the use of the Yorkshire dialect in the text itself, focusing mainly on the speech of Ben Weatherstaff and Dickens Sowerby. Before I get to today's topic, I wanted to share a fantastic letter from listener Pedro, who wrote in recently to say, "In the Cinderella show, you said Rocky is a Cinderella story. I don't buy it. Change my mind." Okay, Pedro, you've baited me. Rocky is definitely not a work for children, but your challenge does allow me to say a few more words on the structure of a Cinderella story. So I'm going to bend the rules for this show's theme and put out a bonus episode on Friday, outside the regular release schedule. If you all enjoy that, maybe I'll do similar bonus episodes from time to time, focusing on things that are a little more for us grown-ups. In using various dialects in her writing, Burnett carefully avoids ever using speech patterns to mock anyone or play into stereotypes. In fact, she did quite a lot to push against the idea that intelligence or morality is directly tied to the way someone speaks. In real life, good and bad people use every kind of dialect, and Burnett's books reflect this. In The Secret Garden, the most sensible, decent, and well-adjusted people speak with thick, rural Yorkshire accents. The posh characters in the book are, by contrast, damaged, selfish, cruel, and unhappy. Some of these miserably well-spoken characters change for the better, especially the two main characters in the book, Mary Lennox and her cousin Colin Craven. The Secret Garden tells the story of Mary Lennox, who is born in India to two horrible parents, a busy British officer and his socialite wife who uses hired help to keep her daughter out of sight. Mary is deeply neglected in her early childhood, leading her to be sour, bratty, and completely unable to show empathy for anyone. Her parents die of cholera, and she is shipped off to England to live with her uncle, Mr. Craven, who lives at a creepy, crumbling estate in Yorkshire, and seems to be equally uninterested in caring for Mary. The only person who shows any kindness to Mary are the lower-status servants at Misselthwaite Manor. Martha Sowerby, a common housemaid, shows her kindly affection. Ben Weatherstaff, the head gardener, is at first gruff, but comes to be fond of Mary as well. Mary befriends Dickon, Martha's little brother, and the two children begin restoring a neglected garden that had belonged to Mrs. Craven before she died. Eventually, Mary discovers that she has a cousin, a sickly boy called Colin who had been hidden from the world. Colin joins Mary and Dickon in the garden, regaining his health as they all spend time outdoors together, learning to care not just for plants, but for animals and one another. Mr. Craven returns home to discover that his house and family have been healed by Mary's rediscovery of the secret garden. The secret garden contrasts two families, The upper class, damaged and unhealthy members of the Craven Lennox clan, who seem to belong nowhere, and the happy, well-adjusted, healthy members of the Sowerby family, who are deeply connected to their community in Yorkshire. As Mary Lennox comes to know Martha and Dickon Sowerby and their mother, Susan, she learns the value of life, real life, metaphorically and literally rooted in a homeland. The grounded existence of the Sowerbys is reflected in their Yorkshire accents, which are distinctively tied to a certain place. By contrast, the upper-class accents of Mary, her cousin Colin, and Colin's father, Mr. Craven, don't belong anywhere. I recently had a conversation about this with listener Kate Duncan, who you can find on Instagram at Nursery Rhymeville. She pointed out that, quote, "The whole reason lots of people send their children to public schools is so that they get the right accent," end quote. And it's depressing, but she's completely right. For quite some time in Britain, the upper class has spoken with an accent called received pronunciation, which strips the speaker of any evidence that he or she belongs to any particular place, and instead signals belonging to the upper crust. When mere mortals have to speak with someone with a higher status accent, something called code switching often happens. This is a linguistic term for when someone shifts between accents, usually to allow them to communicate with and be accepted by different communities. The two accents that must be navigated by the people who live and work at Misselthwaite Manor are upper-class standard British English and the broadest of broad rural Yorkshire dialects. The first example of code switching in the book is done by Mrs. Medlock, the housekeeper at Misselthwaite. She speaks to Mary in a standard dialect when she first collects her in London after a long trip from India. But as soon as they arrive at the train station in rural Yorkshire, Mrs. Medlock changes her speech to her natural dialect. The station master spoke to Mrs. Medlock in a rough, good-natured way, pronouncing his words in a queer, broad fashion, which Mary found out afterward was Yorkshire.
"I see tha's got back," he said. "And tha's brought the young'un with thee?"
"Aye, that's her,"
answered Mrs. Medlock, speaking with a Yorkshire accent herself and jerking her head over her shoulder toward Mary.
"How's tha, missus?" "Well enow. The carriage is waiting outside for thee."
Mrs. Medlock code switches so she can be a member of the same group as the person she speaks with. Her native dialect is Yorkshire, but she speaks standard upper-class speech for her job. Mrs. Medlock would never dream of speaking Yorkshire to Mary or Mr. Craven. She would also never speak standard English to her Yorkshire-speaking friends and family. She'd sound fake and pompous, and it would hurt her ability to be accepted as one of them. Everybody code switches to some degree, but some people have to do it more than others. If you're part of the mainstream culture where you live, you don't have to worry about things like being understood or being thought untrustworthy or less intelligent because of the way you speak. A complex tangle of social class, race, educational level, profession, and situation affect how each of us speaks in a given moment. The characters in The Secret Garden understand perfectly well that their speech indicates where they belong in society. It's still true today that in order to get many jobs, you've got to be able to speak and behave in a certain expected way. This was 10 times more true 100 years ago in England. After Mary Lennox's first night at Misselthwaite Manor, she's awakened by Martha, a housemaid who is casual, friendly, and chatty. Mary openly criticizes this.
"You are a strange servant," she said from her pillows, rather haughtily.
Martha sat up on her heels with her blacking brush in her hand and laughed, without seeming the least out of temper.
"Eh, I know that," she said. "If there was a grand missus at Misselthwaite, I should never have been one of the under-housemaids. I might have been let to be scullery maid, but I'd never been let upstairs. I'm too common and I talk too much Yorkshire. But this is a funny house for all it's so grand. Seems like there's neither master nor mistress except Mr. Pitcher and Mrs. Medlock. Mr. Craven, he won't be troubled about anything when he's here, and he's nearly always away. Mrs. Medlock gave me the place out of kindness. She told me she never could have done it if Misselthwaite had been like other big houses.
Mrs. Medlock wasn't being unkind by pointing out Martha's lack of qualification to be a housemaid. Serving an upper-class family in a fancy house required a certain demeanor and style of speech. Martha can speak slightly more standard English while at work. We know this because she occasionally slips back into a more broad dialect when she's surprised. But Martha can't speak fully standard English, and she doesn't have the quiet, unintrusive demeanor required of housemaids in grand country estates. When the master of the house is never home, and there's no mistress to mind things more closely or host parties, Martha's common speech isn't a problem. There are no snobs around to hear it. Mary starts off as the kind of person who screams at the top of her voice to an English servant that Indian servants aren't people. That's an exact quote. Yikes. But she's just expressing the kind of ignorant bigotry of a child who has never questioned herself or the world around her. She starts small by finding that she has interest in other people. Then she moves on to trying to understand them. Finally, she's able to show empathy for others. The pathway for this process is speech. Mary is at first offended by Martha's speech, but quickly becomes fond of it. After Martha's monthly day off, she comes back to tell Mary that her mother had expressed concern that Mary had no mother, no governess, and no teacher to look after her. Martha reports her mother's words.
"Now, Martha, you just think how you'd feel yourself in a big place like that, wandering about all alone and no mother. You do your best to cheer her up," she says, and I said I would.
Mary gave her a long, steady look.
"You do cheer me up," she said. "I like to hear you talk."
Eventually, Mary will be instructed by Dickon, Martha's younger brother, in how to speak Yorkshire. Dickon never code switches, speaking only his native broad dialect with Mary. There's no reason for him to code switch, as he has nothing to gain and no one to impress by doing so. The first word Mary learns is wick, meaning lively. Eventually, Mary herself begins to code switch, and her first use of Yorkshire is also her first direct effort to make a connection with another human being. Mary is in the garden with Dickon, and she understands that it's a compliment to make an effort to learn the speech of others. She also knows that people can't really connect anyway unless they're speaking the same language. Then Mary did a strange thing. She leaned forward and asked him a question she had never dreamed of asking anyone before. And she tried to ask it in Yorkshire, because that was his language, and in India, a native was always pleased if you knew his speech.
"Does tha like me?" she said.
"Eh,"
he answered heartily. "That I does. I likes thee wonderful, and so does the robin, I do believe."
"That's two, then," said Mary. "That's two for me."
Mary becomes so comfortable using Yorkshire that once she slips and uses it in front of her cousin's doctor. Because she's speaking to a fellow upper-class person, Mary has to quickly defend her speech as not a genuine expression, but merely as an intellectual pursuit.
"Did Dickon teach you that?" asked Dr. Craven, laughing outright.
"I'm learning it as if it was French," said Mary, rather coldly. "It's like a native dialect in India. Very clever people try to learn them. I like it, and so does Colin."
"Well, well," he said, "if it amuses you, perhaps it won't do you any harm." The fact that Mary gives such a false explanation for her interest in Yorkshire speech shows that she understands that people of her social class are expected not to speak that way. And the fact that the doctor dismisses it as a source of childish amusement instead of a legitimately interesting form of communication shows how little value the upper class placed on the speech of those beneath them. In our discussion about the secret garden, Kate Duncan described to me how the same sort of imitation happened in her household.
I'm currently reading The Secret Garden to my children, and I put on the Yorkshire accent myself when I do it. And the children have been, so the 9-year-old and the 5-year-old, they've been speaking Yorkshire themselves. And after putting on the accent for the book, I keep finding myself falling into it, and so do the children. And it's funny, especially after reading all that she says about Yorkshire in The Secret Garden, and how the children, how Colin and Mary both slip into it as well and try and speak it as well. It's funny.
What Kate's describing is completely natural. Our speech is not a permanent trait. We're always being influenced by the people around us, and that can include fictional people in the stories we read in books and watch on TV. Imitation is the highest form of flattery, so I think it's great that you and your children are discovering the Yorkshire dialect the way Frances Hodgson Burnett invited us all to with The Secret Garden. Next week, I'll look more closely at the Yorkshire dialect itself, but for now, here's an activity that helps students think about the concept of code switching. This is an idea that most kids from an upper middle class or upper class background will not have thought about much or even heard of. Funny enough, for a book that's mostly about very rich people, I've found that students from a working class background pick up on the themes around language much better than their higher socioeconomic counterparts. I've also had some very enlightening personal conversations over the years on the topic of code switching with friends who are Black and Latino. From a very young age, they had extremely direct conversations with their parents about how to modify their speech to help them get on better in school or even protect their physical safety in certain situations. This writing assignment is a self-reflection on speech. Ask your students to write out answers to the following questions. 1. Describe the way your speech changes depending on where you are. Examples of locations might include schools, libraries, shops, places of worship, outdoor places, or places of business. 2. Describe the way your speech changes depending on with whom you are speaking. Examples of people might include friends, family members, teachers, strangers, community leaders, or someone who is a different age from you. 3. Do you feel that the way you speak makes it difficult or easy for you to fit in some situations? Why? These questions may be very straightforward for many students, but for others, this may be a sensitive area. You know your kids best. If one of your students has a speech impediment or comes from an immigrant or minority background, be sure that you handle any discussion with that child sensitively. It may be a really neat opportunity for certain children to share their experiences, but others may wish to keep their stories private. That's why I recommend that this activity begins as a personal writing exercise, with sharing done on a voluntary basis. We can think that in the 21st century we're beyond such notions as social class and a hierarchy of dialects, but this is still a relevant issue today. The Secret Garden has many secrets, and just one of them is helping all of us to think about speech, power, and where we belong. You've been listening to the Children's Literature Podcast. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts and give the show a rating. Send comments to letters at childrensliteraturepodcast.com. I'm your host, TQ Townsend. Thanks for listening.